This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Joe Palca, sitting in for Ira Flatow. A bit later in this hour, we'll be talking with Nobel laureate Mike Bishop about the Nobel Prizes and his unexpected life in science. But first, scientists announced this week that they've decoded human chromosome number 7. With more than 1,000 genes, this is the largest of our 24 chromosomes to be decoded so far. Chromosome 7 contains genes linked to cystic fibrosis, as well as hereditary deafness and cancer. The sequence may play a significant role in helping to develop treatments for these diseases. We'll start the hour today talking about some of the secrets of 7. If you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK, TALK. If you want more information about what we'll be talking about this hour, go to our website, www.sciencefriday.com, where you'll find links to our topic. Now let me introduce my guest. Richard Wilson is the director of the Genome Sequencing Center at the Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis. He joins me today by phone from his office there. Welcome to the program, Dr. Wilson.
Thanks, Joe.
So, chromosome 7, you know, one of the things I just started wondering about is how do you get to, which one did you get assigned? I mean, how do you get, who picked 7? And I know somebody at MIT picked Y. I mean, did you guys sit down one day and split it up and say, here's how we're going to do it?
Well, actually, that's exactly what we did at one point. Although 7 has a little bit older history, we actually started working on chromosome 7 back in the early 90s. A colleague and friend of mine, Eric Green, who's now at the NIH, used to be here in St. Louis at Washington University, and was working on physical mapping, in other words, just trying to capture parts of various chromosomes. And part of his reason for doing that was because he wanted to sequence and characterize the gene for cystic fibrosis, which is located on chromosome 7.
Right.
So as a part of that effort, Eric built an excellent map of chromosome 7. And when it came time in the mid-90s to actually start trying to do some large-scale sequencing of the human genome, chromosome 7 was in pretty good shape, and we figured we'd just get started right there.
What is a map? What is a map of a chromosome?
Well, a map of a chromosome can be a number of things. We talk about physical maps, and physical maps are useful to those of us who want to do DNA sequencing, because a physical map essentially gives you all of the puzzle pieces, small fragments of a chromosome or a genome, in the order that they lie along a chromosome. So basically you work your way across, we call it a path, from one end of the chromosome to another. We can't sequence whole chromosomes in one shot in our machines, but we can do them bit by bit, and so the map provides us with those bits.
And how to line them up.
Yep.
Right. Okay. So tell me something about some of the interesting things that we already know about chromosome 7.
Well, we knew there were a few genes on there before we got started. As I said, we knew the gene for cystic fibrosis was on there. This was cloned and sequenced in the mid-90s. Actually, Francis Collins' group was the first one to have a good look at the CF gene. And as soon as we got the sequence of that and understood what kind of protein the gene encoded, that helped us understand what actually went wrong in CF. And for any disease, that's really the first step. If you want to try to understand how you might better treat or perhaps even eventually cure a disease, you need to understand the underlying genetic and other molecular mechanisms. So sequencing buys you that right away. As soon as you can associate a gene with a disease, you start to understand how the disease ticks.
What else you got on 7 besides CF?
Well, 7's got, as you alluded to, there is a gene for hereditary deafness, an illness called Pendred syndrome, which accounts for a fair fraction of hereditary deafness. This is another gene that we discovered along the way a couple years ago as we sequenced chromosome 7. And not only has it allowed us to understand what goes wrong in that particular type of deafness, but by having isolated one of the integral proteins in the human hearing mechanism, we better understand how the normal ear works and how normal hearing works, as well as this particular disease. So that's actually been quite fascinating work. Besides that, there are a lot of genes on chromosome 7 that we believe to be associated with various types of cancers, specifically some leukemias and lymphomas. And now with those sequences in hand, what we're able to do is go back and look at some patient samples and try to correlate sequence changes that we see in those patients' DNA with possible initiation of those cancers.
I have to ask you one other question that's been bothering me a bit. So we know a lot of things that are already on chromosome 7.
Mm-hmm.
What does the sequence really give us? How much more do we get by having the sequence in hand?
It gives you high resolution. Before there was a map of the United States, you might have known that St. Louis was somewhere in the middle of the country, but you really didn't know how to get there, and you didn't have any details about what to do when you got there. So having the sequence really is the fine details. If I am interested, say, in finding a gene that might be important in a particular type of cancer and designing a drug that might interfere with that mutated protein's effects, I've got to know all of the fine details. And so sequencing really gets you there. It helps you understand what's going on down to the molecular nuts and bolts and lets you think about what you do next.
Right. But the sequence itself doesn't say, here's the gene for this disease or here's the gene for that disease.
No, in just the same way that the alphabet doesn't tell you exactly everything about the particular book you're reading. You have to interpret it. You have to turn the letters into information. And that's really the next step. We do part of that right away at the sequencing center. Anytime we sequence a genome or a chromosome or part of a chromosome, we can do some initial analysis to try to get an idea of where genes are. I think that's another one of the sort of milestones that is represented in this paper, is that between the time that the first finished human chromosome sequence was published a couple years ago, chromosome 22, we've really learned how to look at sequence information and find genes and annotate those genes and say, you know, this is a gene that's functional, it's similar to a gene for something else that we know a little bit about, and we can make some reasonable statements as to what that gene might do. So that's part of it. And then, you know, really where you go from there is to look, let's say, at individual patient DNAs, people that have the disease that you're interested in, and try to correlate sequence changes that you see there with the effects.
Okay. Let's invite our listeners to join this conversation. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. Scott from Stockton, California. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hi.
Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Oh, great.
My question, I've two, if I can ask. One is, how many base pairs are in the typical gene? I mean, just in sort of an idea of the magnitude of that number. And the second is, he mentioned being able to deduce the protein from looking at the gene sequence. And we've heard that it's something like a template, you know, in school. So is that, in fact, how you get that protein? And, that's my question. I can take my answer off the air.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Good question. Genes are range from anywhere in size to maybe a couple hundred bases to hundreds of thousands of bases, and most of them are subsequently processed down to maybe just a few thousand. In terms of how we deduce a protein from sequence, we know the genetic code, so we know that if you have TTT in the DNA sequence, that for that particular region of the corresponding protein, you have a phenylalanine. What we have to do is also understand the punctuation that's inherent in DNA. So from that 100,000 base pair gene that I just mentioned, we might splice that down into a few thousand bases that actually encode for a protein. And that's actually the trickier part, is to understand the punctuation and to know what parts of the gene actually go into the business end of the final message for protein.
Is that why it's been so hard to figure out how many genes there really are?
Yeah, that's a big part of it. I mean, to some extent, there are other ways that you can independently confirm the presence of a gene in a particular region of a chromosome. And comparative genomics is a very powerful tool as well. So having the mouse sequence, for example, in this past year has really helped us do a better analysis of human chromosome 7. Genomes tend to be very similar in regions where there's conserved function, and very different when there's nothing functional there. So that helps a lot too, and that improves our ability. But still, a lot of this has to be done by algorithmic development, and that's a little bit less certain.
Right. Let's go to Nancy in Harrisonville, Missouri. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Yeah. I was wondering, there's been a sort of a controversy between environmentalists or behaviorists and geneticists to some extent. And I'm wondering if there's going to be, or if there has been and will be, a wave of too much emphasis placed on the genetics and ignoring the environment. I know with children who are receiving large amounts of things like Ritalin and people who are receiving all these neuroleptics, and much of the healthcare industry and the pharmaceutical industry are ignoring the environment, and they're just dosing people with things like this and saying, well, it's because they have this genetic problem. And we, within 30 miles of where I live in Kansas City, Missouri, there's this huge new organization that is devoted to genetics. It's drawing geneticists from all over the world. And I'm just wondering, you know, if this is going to be such an emphasis on genetics that you completely ignore the environment. And I'll hang up and take the answer
okay,
off you.
Okay, thanks, Nancy. What do you think about that, Dr. Wilson?
Well, I think it's an excellent question. I think a biologist or a scientist or a physician that ignores the contribution of both environmental factors as well as genetic factors isn't looking at the right picture, or the whole picture. I think quite clearly, through the work that we have done, and for me, simply observing my sons and learning genetics there as much as I did in graduate school, you clearly can see that there are environmental factors that are very important in how a person develops and behaves and how their health is maintained. You know, quite clearly, in a lot of human cancers, we know that there are genes that basically encode susceptibility, if you will, and it's most likely environmental factors that pull the trigger, and much more easily in people that have a higher susceptibility through their genetic makeup. So it has to be both, and I think it's important that we consider both.
Interesting. What's next on your plate? You're done with 7, or you go to 4 or 6, or what's next?
Well, exactly. We go to 4 and 2. We had just finished chromosome Y about a month ago, which was an interesting chromosome in itself, and now here on 7. So we have human chromosomes 2 and 4. Those are the other chromosomes that we got in that room where we all sat down and figured out who's going to do what. We're also sequencing the mouse genome, as I had mentioned earlier, and most recently the chimpanzee genome, which should be quite interesting in terms of a comparative genomics approach to human. And then the other thing that we're doing here in St. Louis is starting to look at specific genes, which we believe are involved in some types of diseases, in various patient samples to go back and correlate sequence changes that we see in those patients' DNAs with the reference sequence of chromosomes such as 7.
I see. So in other words, you can the reference sequence tells you at least a version of normal, and you can play off that to find disease genes.
That's absolutely right.
Interesting. And chimpanzee, is that going to help us understand why we're so similar in genetics and kind of different in other ways?
Well, I think the main thing that chimpanzee will do is it will help us better analyze and annotate the human sequence. So since the chimpanzee genome sequence is very close to human, we expect that in regions of function that the sequences will be almost identical, where in other regions the sequence will be diverged or different.
Well, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to cut you off there because that's all the time we have. Dr. Wilson, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Richard Wilson is the director of the Genome Sequencing Center at the Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis. We'll be back with Talk of the Nation Science Friday after this break.